Do we need, or is there a purpose for organ-specific clocks, or can we just use one clock and that's a body clock? So the question is, if there are organ-specific clocks, which clock in which organ is ticking well? So which one to use?
Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blander joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question, how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Gil Blander. Welcome to Longevity by Design, how to live longer, better life. We are produced by InstaTracker, your science-based guide to optimize your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. Andrea Mayer. Andrea Mayer is the co-director of the Center of Healthy Longevity at the National University of Singapore. She received her MD in 2003 from the University of Lübeck in Germany. From 2016 to early 2021, Professor Mayer served as a divisional director of medicine and community care at the Royal Marlborough Hospital, Australia, and a professor of medicine and aged care at the University of Marlborough. Professor Mayer's research focuses on revealing the mechanism of aging and age-related diseases. During the last 10 years, she has conducted multiple international observational cohort studies and intervention trials and has published more than 350 peer-reviewed articles. She is a frequent guest on the radio and television program to disseminate aging research and invited a member of several international academic and health policy committees, including the WHO. She is the president of the Australian and New Zealand Society of Sarcopenia and Frailty Research and service as a selected member of the Royal Holland Society of Science and Humanity. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you so much for having me and spending the time.
Thank you. So I would like to start with a brief introduction about yourself, and specifically, why have you decided to become a physician and scientist, and how have you got involved in studying aging and longevity?
I grew up in a GP practice. I think that says a lot. So it's in my genes. My father and my mother were working there. And so it was quite clear that in the end, I would become an MD. However, I wanted to study art and I wanted to have that liberal life. But in the end, that did not happen. Why aging and why geriatrics first? And then I moved much more to the aging field from a clinical perspective. I always did research in the aging field. That's because I was just fascinated by old age, and especially fascinated by old age in good health. So I had a couple of people surrounding me in their 90s who were in such a good shape. I thought, okay, we have to study what's going on. And that's what I do since 20 years.
Excellent. And I know, and I'm not sure that the audience know, that you are working together with Brian Kennedy, which is a dear friend and been a guest in this podcast. And basically, the first graduate student at the Lenny Guerrante Lab that started working on aging. So definitely you are working in a great place in Singapore, and the two of you are doing amazing work there. And I would like to start our discussion on a longevity medicine clinic. And maybe just as the first question, most of our audience, I assume, doesn't know what are longevity medical clinics. It's a pretty new term. And how can you describe it? And what is the difference between normal or traditional medicine clinic and longevity medicine?
Yeah, I'm a trained internal medicine physician and geriatrician as subspecialty. And what we normally do, and we are doing it quite well, and we should be proud of it, we are treating individuals who have a disease following the ICD-11 or 10 code. So that's the International Classification of Diseases. So that's normal practice we grew up with, and I manage lots of hospitals in really regulating that really fantastic care. However, we are aging already from, some say, from conception. Some say you can really show it in the 20s or 30s birthday, but we are aging quite rapidly at middle age. And what we already know that some of our organ systems are declining and declining all the time. And at a certain point, we say, hey, you have a disease, so you should go to an endocrinologist or to a surgeon or whatever. We have so many specialties. And health and longevity medicine is kicking in before we are going to see an endocrinologist or a lung physician or another physician being highly experienced in organ dysfunction. So we are looking at the functioning of the body. And of course, we should also provide that service to individuals in their health and longevity medicine clinics come to the game. And these are quite new. I must say there are no healthy longevity medicine physicians. Lots of individuals call themselves a longevity medicine physicians, but is not yet recognized by any society, medical society yet. And that's what we try to achieve with the Health and Longevity Medicine Society, to really get medical specialities being recognized. So it's a very early field to really work on prevention and to recognize that our body is already aging during the life course. And at a certain point, you are diseased, to prevent that.
Yeah. So one anecdote, I remember when I was on my 30s, my wife came to me and said, hey, I have an age mark on my body. And I told her, unfortunately, the point that you are today is the best point that you will be ever in the future. So basically, it's all downhill from that. She didn't like it, but that's the reality at the end of the day. So that's one anecdote. The second one is just trying to summarize what you said in my voice. So basically, longevity clinics help with preventions and bring the best of your body, best of your body. So basically bring you to the best that you can reach. That's a fair assessment?
Yeah, we have a definition for healthy longevity, and there was what the clinics do. So healthy longevity medicine is optimizing the health span while targeting the aging processes across the life course. Okay. So there are a couple of components here. So it's about health span, to optimize health span. It's about aging mechanisms, we now understand, and it's across the life course, which means it's very integrative in everybody's life, because everybody is welcome in such clinics to optimize health span.
Okay. Now, the question about who is the right client or consumer for the longevity clinics? Basically, can you, if one of our listeners thinking, should I go to longevity clinic or should I stay with my normal primary physician? What are the advice that will tell him to decide whether to go left or right?
Yeah, you don't have to, I wouldn't say you have to choose. It's either left okay. or it's either right. I think we can learn a lot from GP practices. I just said I grew up in a GP practice. So there's lots of good preventative stuff going on there. Think about vaccination. Think about measuring the weights of babies, for example. This is all prevention and risk stratification that we prevent age-related disease much, 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 much later in life. So it's not either or. Very important is that we are targeting, I would say, health in longevity medicine a little bit different. We have other tools than a normal GP at the moment have. And then I'm talking about biological age clocks, looking, for example, at epigenetic markers or the omics approach to look at really new biomarkers, which are not yet readily available in normal conventional healthcare. So our diagnostics is a little bit different, but most importantly, also our interventions are quite different to lower the biological age. What kind of supplements work to lower the biological age, or maybe even what kind of repurposed drugs work to lower the biological age? So, and that's very different. I wouldn't say that I have never seen a GP really stating, okay, what is your biological age? That's really the diagnostic tool for longevity medicine physicians. But again, coming back, it's not either or. I think we shouldn't throw away, or we shouldn't say GP practices are not good enough anymore. Absolutely not. It's really the basis of a wonderful healthcare service, at least in Western countries. And we should work with them and not against them or next to them.
That's great. And again, to summarize, so there are a different or more advanced tools for diagnostic, and the intervention might be a bit more advanced or a bit more geared into looking into longevity, which is great. And related to the clocks, we'll discuss them later. And definitely it's one subject that I want to go very deep. So I want to shift gear with you and discuss about more about mechanism of aging. And we know that there have been a few papers that looked at a few different mechanisms that can cause aging and the specific area that we might be able to intervene. So in your opinion, is it a specific mechanism for aging for each person that we can pinpoint into? Or right now they are very general, and like senescence or oxidative stress or telomeres shortening are applicable for everyone?
I think I have a personal opinion and I know what has been written in the literature. And I think a lot of people already know that we have hallmarks of aging, and in publications, the number of these hallmarks, they differ and they are varying. I grew up that we have 9 hallmarks of aging. I think we have many, many more, and they're also interacting. Your question is, okay, does somebody have a telomere problem or a proteostasis problem or more problems with mitochondria or much more DNA damage? Because these are all the hallmarks of aging. I would say we do not know. We are not yet there at the personalized approach that we say, okay, you have a telomere problem. That's the reason why I'm injecting telomerase. Don't do that at this moment in time. Absolutely no evidence. We do not have the evidence that other people might suffer from a proteostasis problem and therewith have to get medication who are interfering with specifically folding proteins, for example. But what we know is that the contribution of these hallmarks are different between individuals. So what does that mean? That some people might have less senescent cells compared to others, but might have different problems. And to make it even more complicated, that's between individuals, but within one individual, it might be that our heart or my heart might suffer from different aging processes compared to my brain or to my lungs, depending on what kind of environmental damage there is. For example, smoking. I absolutely do not smoke, but if I would smoke, I would expose my lungs to toxins, which heavily are associated with ROS, for example, and therewith give lots of DNA damage, and therewith also more propensity for cancer. So dependent on within an individual, the organ you are targeting, the mechanisms might also be different based on how it's used and how much and when we expose these organs to negative influences.
Okay, that's a great answer. And focusing or zooming in into the senescent cells, so do we know if there are specific diseases that are more prone to senescent cells than other that are less?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the senescent cells are the cells who are not dividing. We think they are not dividing anymore, still in the body and very likely negatively influencing the microenvironment. And there was inducing lots of age-related diseases under which cancer. That's the hypothesis. We did lots of research in the past to see if individuals with age-related diseases have a higher senescence load, so more senescent cells in, for example, the skin, but also in the lungs, in the brain, everywhere where researchers did investigations on. And what we were able to see is that the senescence load is much, much higher with chronological age. That's what we expect, because that's also the reason why it's a hallmark of aging. On the other hand side, individuals of the same chronological age but with an age-related disease have many more senescent cells in their body and independent of the organ where the disease is. So if you take, for example, blood from patients with heart failure and compare them to individuals of the same age and sex without a heart failure, these individuals have, for example, in the blood, but also in the heart, much more senescent cells. So it goes with chronological age, but also with a biological age, and then determined by age-related diseases. You ask which disease? That's a little bit tricky, because there are not many studies who do really a comparison in one group, how many more you find in, for example, kidney transplant patients. So we do not know. But what we know is that the senescence load in, for example, the pancreas and then in the brain is much higher compared to other organs such as the colon or the thymus, which also makes sense because they are not replicative anymore, for example, the thymus much, much later in life.
And what can we do? Let's assume that a specific person somehow identified that he has a lot of senescent cells in a specific organ. I know that today you cannot do a lot, but if we'll fast forward 5 or 10 years into the future, what in your opinion will be the intervention to treat those senescent cells?
Yeah, first of all, there is already not a treatment, but there is prevention. So there are already a couple of studies showing that with lifestyle interventions, for example, being on a treadmill for 3 times a week for 30 minutes reduces the number of senescent cells in blood. So we already know that we can manipulate the number of senescent cells. If we therewith also reduce the risk of an age-related disease, I don't know. But what we know is that the numbers are changing while having better lifestyle habits. And I think that's very, very important. I think you are targeting a little bit more the supplement and the drugs, how to remove senescent cells. So these are the senolytics, really interfering with senescent cells, either inducing apoptosis or the programmed cell death of these individuals. These are indeed already in phase 1 and phase 2A studies, where it's tested in humans to see, of course, with the hypothesis, if you have an accumulation of senescent cells, these are bad for the environment. They give a higher risk of age-related diseases. Let's remove them. And there are a couple of these drugs being tested. A couple of phase 1 studies show that the side effects are okay, but the definitive studies to actually see if they have an effect on removing cells, that might be possible, but there was also having a clinically relevant effect, we don't know yet. So there are a couple of I think, years to go until we know if they are clinically meaningful. We also have to consider that every medication, every drug has an effect. That's the reason why we give it. But as a physician, I also would like to highlight that if there is an effect, most of the times there is also a side effect, because that's the reason why it works. And we do not really know how many senescent cells we possibly need in our body, because they are senescent to suppress, for example, cancer, because that cell cannot divide, but with side effects for the environment. So we have to learn, I think, how much effect we will gain by giving senolytics. Also, when to give them. Should we start in our 30s or 50s or 70s? We absolutely do not know yet and will take time, especially in earlier ages. And we also have to learn how many side effects we will have to then have a gain-risk ratio to actually see if it makes sense to give these kind of senolytics.
Yeah, that's a very important point. And I remember as a graduate student at the Weizmann Institute long ago, I worked actually on senescent cells, and the dogma there was that they are actually there in order to prevent cancer because the telomeres are shortening, and then if not, they become mutated and become a cancer cell. So it's definitely a point to keep in mind, and I think that the important take-home message for everyone is, as you said, every drug has an effect, but it also has a most likely side effect, and we need to be careful not to jump on a specific drug that someone posts on Twitter and start using it off target because someone said it, be sure that it's safe and got the FDA approval or something like that before you're taking a drug off target. Be careful.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I think being also on Twitter and on LinkedIn, sometimes I see messages where I think, I'm not sure if that's a good message to communicate to the crowd and very often laymen, because it's quite easy to get drugs already via different sources. And that's here I stop.
In the black market, let's say.
Yeah. So I think experimenting with yourself has risks. Some take the risks, but please be careful in building a crowd out of it. And I would highlight there are lots of randomized controlled trials, lots of trials. Look at the trial registry and just be in contact with researchers, and there will be a sufficient and a very nice trial also for you.
Yeah. So my next question is more about zooming out from the cellular level into the organ level and ask you a question about, do you see that the different organs age differently in the different pace? And if yes, which of them age fastest and which of them age slowest?
You always ask questions which I cannot answer. At least the second question I cannot really
That's
answer.
Okay.
But what we know is that the pace of aging within a body is different. So we used a huge database, the UK Biobank, with more than 150,000 individuals. And we took only individuals who are healthy. And we looked at trajectories of decline of organs in these individuals. And what we were able to do is a network analysis to say, okay, in the first 6 years of the data we had, what kind of function of the organ is declining? And what kind of organ is following? And that's very, very important, because if we understand what the trajectory is of decline in a body, we can also then do diagnostics very specifically for a certain organ. We found, for example, that the lung function, if the lung function is going down in the first 6 years of follow-up, that's very highly associated with decline in a cardiac function in the next 6 years. However, in participants where the heart function was going down, there was not the decline in lung function, which means that there is not a bidirectional association, but a one-way association, which also means if you are thinking about the normal healthcare services we already have, you say, okay, if I have an individual with a declining lung function, it would be very good to also have a cardiac function test later in life and to prevent, for example, heart failure. On the other hand side, if somebody visits the cardiologist, that doesn't mean that per se that person has to go to the pulmonologist, because it's just one direction. And what we also found is that especially the musculoskeletal system is very important in that network and is really highly interconnected. So if the muscle function and the muscle mass is going down, that's never a good sign. That is the precursor of lots of other organs also declining. So from a GP perspective, therewith, it's very important to measure muscle strength and muscle mass already now in clinical practice, because I like the clinical part to be implemented if we already have knowledge, and the musculoskeletal system is very important and very easy to measure.
That's very interesting. And the question is, do we see a variability in organ aging between humans? Meaning, can my lung age faster than yours, but your muscle will age faster than me? Is it something that we see, or can we see it?
Yes, we can see that. And I think that's also the reason why there are groups of individuals with more cardiovascular-related diseases at the age of 60 versus some with more neurodegenerative disease, for example, dementia. So there are absolutely traits of individuals who might suffer from different, and we are now coming back to the hallmarks of aging, traits of which hallmarks are more pronounced, which then lead to certain age-related diseases in certain organs. And there's absolutely a variation in how humans age. So for the next coming 5 to 10 years, I think for us is to understand how we can measure that, to then very individualized intervene for these individuals, that we really treat the ones who need to be treated for certain aging-related functional declines in certain organs.
Excellent. And that's a great segue for the aging clock. So I would like to start by you explaining to our audience in the simplest way as possible. What are the aging clocks? What are the origin for them? And why are we using them?
Yeah, I would say aging clocks are a little bit, a hype. So it's just nice and it's very sexy to say, okay, we have a diagnostics and we call it clock and everybody understands it. At least it seems to be very fascinating for the audience. And for clients. So clocks are nothing else than comparing a parameter which we can measure in the body and compare that in the first instance to the chronological age. So how is a 40-year-old doing compared to another 40-year-old? That's it. So it's very easy. It's just repurposing data we already had and then expressing it as a clock. And the unit of a clock is years. That's it. You are biologically younger, 3 years, 5 years, 1.5 years, whatever, compared to a certain individual of the same chronological age. So these were the investigations, and we call them the first generation clock. I don't think that these, of course, have value, but trying to compare somebody to the same age group, I think we already did 30 or 40 years ago. What's much more important is to see other biological characteristics in the body. It can be a blood pressure. It can be an epigenetic makeup. It can be a glucose. Can be lots of variables. Are these variables predictive in the future for bad outcome? And the bad outcome can be mortality, so death, or it can be the incidence of a disease. And these are the second generation clocks. So these are trained to predict a bad outcome. And there, for me at least, becomes it much more relevant because I, as a clinician, I want to prevent that bad outcome. And I want to know who is at risk for that bad outcome. And that person at risk for the bad outcome therewith has a higher biological age using that clock. Mm-hmm. And so that's the entire rationale and framework. So the first generation clocks are trained to predict the chronological age. The second generation clocks are predicting the bad outcomes. And what are the variables we are including? There are lots. We have a muscle clock. We have a brain clock. We have a blood clock. We have an epigenetic clock. There are lots of clocks. And I think that's also a little bit the trouble of our field, if I may, because there's so many clocks that nobody really knows how the time is ticking because all the clocks are also quite different. And I think you will ask me maybe what is my favorite clock?
You saved my question, so let's answer it.
So I don't have a favorite clock. From an academic point of view, I want an accurate clock. And now, of course, the question, what is the most accurate clock? And I think the opinions are a little bit diverse in the field. I would say that I only accept a diagnostic marker in clinical practice to use it if the accuracy is at least 80-90% with a high sensitivity and a high specificity. Do these clocks have that yet? No, we don't know, because most of the times we are just looking at associations and say a 3 years younger individual has 2 times lesser risk of death, for example. That doesn't mean that for that person, the clock is accurate, because it's just an association and the association is on group level. So what we need in our field is many more studies where we really look at accuracy and looking at not only the area under the curve, but also a sensitivity and specificity and a predicted values, positive and negative ones.
Excellent. And a follow-up question that is a bit geeking out and talking a bit more about statistics, but I think that it's important here, is related to the R value of the clock. So theoretically, you can get to R value of one, but that's a bit limitation because actually, I would like you to explain to the audience why it's a limitation if the correlation between the clock age and your chronological age is one to one. What happened? Why it's not good? Why we don't would like to have a bit more flexibility?
Yeah. So the first generation clocks are there to be trained to as best as possible predict chronological age. And if it's a R value, so the correlation coefficient is one, that means that the biological age is the same as the chronological age. That does not make sense because you want a diagnostic tool to say what your biological age is. And otherwise, you can just look at the passport. That's your age. And that's a chronological age. So I'm always very happy if I have to review papers or see slides where an R value is being given of a 0.7. Most of the times, then it says, oh, the R value is low. And I say, yes, this is good. So I would like to have a clock which is not predictive as an R value of one for chronological age, but around a 0.7 roughly. A 0.8 is also very good already predicting chronological age. That's not the purpose. Because I would like to see that the biological clock is associated with biological variance. So I need a variance of the biological age varying around that chronological age range. And that's most important. And then I have something in hand, which could also be sensitive to change if I do an intervention and I would be, for example, 5 years older. I do a certain intervention. I would like to see that that age gap between the biological and the chronological age of -5 goes to -4, -3, -2, etc. And then I know that my intervention worked. If the R value would be one, then I would just stay at my chronological age.
That was a very good and a simple explanation. Thank you so much. I think that it's very important for our audience. And recently I listened to your presentation and you develop a clock, which I assume around 120 different features that are mostly clinical features. And in that regard, you showed which one, which feature is the most predictor or making you the younger and a few that make you older. And I'm sure that it's very interesting for the audience to know if they can take something out of this discussion. What are the activities that people are doing that make them or make most of us older? And what are the activities that make most of us younger? Can you give us a few tips about that?
Yes. So we designed the clocks based on physical parameters, which means measuring the blood pressure, looking at the cholesterol level. So everything every GP could already do, which is great. And then we said, okay, individuals with a higher or a lower biological age, what kind of characteristics do they have? And one of the very surprising characteristics, but very logical characteristics is if somebody is younger, that's associated, for example, with more green space around that person where a person is living. And of course, that makes sense because you are very likely not living in a very crowded city. You have more space to do exercises and to walk, etc. But also social connectivity is very important. So individuals who say, yes, I have friends, are biologically younger compared to the ones who do say, okay, yeah, my friends are limited to one or two and I'm socially isolated, for example. And there are other factors like lifestyle factors. If the sleep quality is the impression of that individual that the sleep quality is poor, that's also associated with a higher biological age, et cetera, et cetera. So all the obvious things, but I like the obvious things to then go and have a good conversation with politicians to say, okay, what do we do with this information? And how do we shape the environment, that we could, of course, likely influence that biological age characteristic of lots of individuals living there. And of course, this is not causally related, but this is what we are doing in Singapore at the moment to actually see, can we do research while increasing the green space or in making differences and changes in the environment where people live to actually prove that people are biologically younger in the end?
Yeah, and I think that that's a very good point about taking a basic research as you've done about the clocks and that now moving into public health and going to a government. And in that regard, Singapore, I think that is the leading in being reactive to science and like science and pushing it to the population. I know that a lot of other governments are less flexible about that, but I think that that's great. It can be a great example or a pilot for all of us all over the world. What can we do based on science and then testing it in a country that is in the size of city and see what are, is it really working or not? Is it just an assumption of a scientist, which is really amazing. And thank you so much for sharing that. In the same presentation, you also showed that you develop a organ clock. So you look at a few different organs and basically measure the clock of each of them. Can you elaborate a bit about that and what were the discoveries or what were the exciting discoveries from the organ-specific clocks?
Yeah, so the underlying question is, do we need or is there a purpose for organ-specific clocks or can we just use one clock and that's a body clock? So the question is, and if there are organ-specific clocks, which clock in which organ is ticking well? So which one to use? And that was the entire exercise to compare different organ-specific clocks, for example, a heart clock, a lung clock, a brain clock, and then compare that to an overall clock. And we compared them by judging how good they are to predict age-related diseases. And what we found is that all organ-specific clocks, they are quite okay and good to predict age-related diseases, even in other organ systems. However, the body clock was much, much better in as a second-generation clock in predicting age-related diseases, but also immortality. And I think that's interesting, which means we already touched on this. Do organs, do they age differently? Yes, they do. That's also the reason why the organ-specific clocks give a little bit different results within an individual. But if we are looking at an overall outcome, for example, mortality, then the overall health, the overall biological clock is much more predictive compared to all these tiny clocks, which means also from a clinical perspective, I think we have to introduce a more global clock. If the global clock is showing that the biological age is higher, then we can do a deep dive into different organs to see where is the origin of that accelerated aging process.
Okay, good. And just to summarize this part, you develop a clock that is based on features that coming from a regular GP or data that is medical grade. There are a lot of clocks right now, and the most important one is the epigenetic clock that coming based on a methylation of your DNA. They have been shown to be the most accurate, but they are less, again, my interpretation is there less interaction or less knowledge why they are predictive of aging or longevity or anything else. So I would like to hear from you, if you can. I know that it's a very sensitive subject in the aging research domain, but what is your interpretation of the epigenetic clock, which have the highest amount of buzz right now?
I'm absolutely not political. So the only thing which counts is where's the evidence? And there's absolutely a hype. We also use in my lab the epigenetic clocks and using at the moment 5 different algorithms. So I love the epigenetic clock. But again, I'm not sure how accurate that is. I'm not very convinced if we really need to know why of what really happens, which CpG sites are methylated and why it's so good. at a clinician, I need a biomarker which is sensitive for a certain outcome. So it has to be accurate. So even yellow fingers are a very good biomarker for lung cancer. So if I don't say that this holds also for the epigenetic clock, but not always using a biomarker, causality has to be proven. From an academic perspective, of course, I would like to know why the epigenetic clock is so predictive, for example, for the incidence of diabetes and mortality. And they're really working well. What we don't know yet for the epigenetic clocks is, of course, why and how sensitive they are for change. And I, with my group, we are jumping at the moment in very cold water. we are doing trials where we have is not only a selection parameter of inclusion, we are including 40 to 60-year-old individuals, but we only include individuals who are healthy. However, these healthy individuals have a higher biological age based on the epigenetic clock, based on four different algorithms we apply to that. And then we make a composite score. And this is also our outcome parameter, which means that hopefully there is enough change during our course of the intervention that we see a result. And I think nobody really knows. But I think the power of the epigenome or the entire methylation is so fantastic because we already know that our lifestyle really has a sort of fingerprint on our DNA and can switch on and off genes, and they can modify gene deserts. And what that really means in terms of health outcomes, we don't know. But what is so exciting, and that's the reason why I always have a big smile if I hear about epigenetics, is that it's modifiable. And that's what we want in clinical care. We want modifiable factors we can easily measure. And lots of investigations around the world are now looking at, okay, if one CPC site is being methylated, what does it mean and in which condition? And I think that's the next step. For now, I think it's the biomarker to introduce in clinical practice, which I already did and I'm going to do in the coming months.
Yeah, that's actually a great segue for my next question. So if a physician or a longevity physician or a practitioner would like to add the aging clock into his or her practice, what do you recommend them to do? What is the right step to do it?
It depends on the embedding of that physician. If you have an academic lab next to your clinic, which most often is not available, then yes, please measure epigenetic ages, etc. What I would suggest is very easy measures in the beginning as a kickoff and start off of physicians who would like to measure the biological age. One very easy one is measuring the pathology data you would already do. So measuring a liver function, creatinine, etc. And there are a couple of algorithms already to therewith measure and calculate the biological age out of hematological and other parameters, which is, I think, the first step. How sensitive these are in terms of change is also not really known, but you can at least use that a diagnosticum when you have the first conversation with your client and saying, okay, you're tracking towards an older age, younger age, etc. But very easy parameters. And for example, in muscle strength and gait analysis is already very informative. If you have the lab in hand, go for epigenetic makeups, go for measuring the genetic contribution of that individuals, go and have an omic approach, etc. But I would say that I only know a couple of clinics which are able to do that and not even sure if that's very accurate.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. And my next question, you partially answered it, but I think that it will be good to spend some time on that. So you said that at least for the epigenetic clock, they can predict if you have diabetes or a different disease. So what is your view about that? Can we look at whatever clock you have and then come and say, because you are older than your age, you have a 2x chance to have diabetes or cardiovascular diseases or any other diseases, or we are not there yet?
I would say we are not there yet. What we first have to do in clinical practice to implement the risk scorings we already have in hands, which are validated and which are quite accurate. So I would never say now we have clocks. So therewith we do not have to measure a glucose or a fructosamine or an HbA1c. Don't do that because they are very good markers for an incidence of diabetes. Where the biological clock kicks in is in addition to the conventional markers of cardiovascular disease. So none of the clocks work better than measuring, for example, the blood pressure in millimeter mercury to predict if somebody has hypertension, because you have to measure that organ, the vascular system, to actually see if it's working or not. So I really see the entire development of longevity medicine embedded and not separated, but embedded into internal medicine, because we learned that the last 50 to 100 years so much. Let's do not throw that away because we have clocks and that's very attractive and that sells nice, but we have to embed it in care, which is already good and a very high standard, and test if the combinations work and they are better. And I will give you one example. So we have a cardiovascular risk screening where we are measuring an LDL and we are measuring the blood pressure and a BMI, etc. And then there's a certain risk. What kind of studies I would like to see in the field is then adding our risk, our biological clocks to see if we are predicting much, much better there with cardiovascular risk. So now we very often test our biological clocks in isolation, but let them either compete or add them towards the risk factors we already know. And I think that would really gain lots of information and transform care embedded, but not isolated.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. A very good suggestion. And I agree with you that some of the clocks are a bit, they are overpromised right now, and we need to be careful about the interpretation of that. So, Andrea, I would like to finish by a question that we are asking every guest that we have. And the tip is, what do you recommend to do in order to improve health span? Or specifically, what do you do in order to live a better, longer?
I think I'm an outsider in this field. I do not take any supplements. I do not take any Rapalox or repurposed drugs. No, I don't do that because I'm a hardcore scientist. And I first want to have my randomized controlled trials to be able to see what kind of effect I gain. That's from a supplement and repurposed drug perspective. So I do not self-experiment with these kind of things. So you won't see me on Twitter saying, yes, I did this and that. On the other hand side, I think I have a very, very good diet. I love French fries on Fridays. But on the other hand side, I'm already for decades vegetarian, and without knowing that this would increase my health span. But this is not very important because I see lots of my colleagues running around and being on treadmills, etc. I think most importantly is for me that I love my work. And therewith, I am happy. I have a very nice environment. I live, I have a dog and a husband, and that makes me happy. And this is, sorry to be very personal, but I think this is very important also for our field. We are really looking at the functionality of our body and what we should really try to do in our investigations to have many more associations and investigations with health psychologists to actually see how we can nudge individuals into the right direction, not only of the behavior, but also to enjoy life.
That's an excellent tip and a unique one, and I really like it. Don't run after the new drug that someone said in Twitter, but go to the basic, love your work, do your work well, love your family, spend time with them, and maybe have a dog. That's a unique one, which is, I know that people with dogs are much more friendly. So maybe it's connected to the friendliness that you said, and maybe to the green area, because when you have a dog, you need to take him outside, which is a great connection to your epigenetic clock part. So, Andrea, that was a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much. And we look forward to exploring the research in the field of longevity each month with you and the leading scientists. For more information, please go to insotracker.com/podcast. Thank you so much again, Andrea.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by Inside Tracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit insidetracker.com/podcast.